A Queensland fisherman has caught a massive 284-gram prawn off the Fraser Coast this week. Flooding in the region has led to some exciting catches, but overall, numbers are down. And prices at the shops could make your eyes pop this year, as Kelly Buchanan explains.
When John Helmuth pulled in his nets while trawling for king prawns on the Fraser Coast, he caught a little more than he'd bargained for.
He was quite impressive. 284 grams. We didn't actually measure it.
About as long as my forearm, but tips to my elbow.
And that's probably the best one I've seen in a while.
He's talking about a leader prawn, as long as his wife Amanda's arm, dark across its back and resembling a lobster more than something you might throw on the barbie. Anchored 4 miles north of the Wide Bay Bar, Mr. Helmuth says he doesn't often find such big prawns in his nets, but the recent floods have led to a flush in southern prawns, and a few surprises as well.
We're actually getting good catches, and part of that is due to the murky water, all the silt, food, the prawns are loving it at the moment. We've had a really good couple of weeks. I know they did have a lot of state in the floods down at Brisbane, and I know they're catching them down in Brisbane in the Moreton Bay.
While the monster crustacean might have you salivating, rising prices and low supply could take prawns off the table this Easter. Mackay Fish Market owner David Caracciolo says it's a very different season in the north, where fishermen are lamenting a second failed wet.
Made a terrible impact on the start to our season. We've virtually had no banana prawns at all. There was a few trawlers here earlier on, and they went looking, but the catches were very poor, and it's not looking very good at all at this stage.
And I mean, we're only talking a little while into the season. That's not real encouraging.
No, and your banana prawn season only lasts a little while. It's sort of virtually March through to May, June. So we've only got sort of another few weeks. I have had good reports out of the Gulf of Carpentaria. Apparently some of the blokes up there have been catching quite well. I haven't heard it firsthand. It's only sort of through industry talk. But the Gulf seems to be going quite well in the start. So it's only 4 or 5 days into the start. Some of the blokes are unloading already, apparently.
What's been the feeling around the retail aspect of it?
Well, those banana prawns I just mentioned in the Gulf won't get to market for Easter, unfortunately. The prawns are scarce. As I said, it's been a terrible season in the central Queensland area here from virtually Gladstone, Yeppoon, Mackay, and I don't think Townsville's doing very well from reports. So prawns probably will be scarce for Easter unless something happens very soon.
So you want to be thinking about getting your orders in pretty soon, I imagine, then?
Well, that'd be the safe bet, is to get them early. Frozen prawns are quite good. They're frozen at sea on the boats. They thaw back quite well, as long as you know how to thaw them back. You can buy frozen cartons of prawns and put them in the freezer, and you know, you're not subject to the supply and demand of the last week.
What would it take to turn the season around? Is it possible at this stage?
I don't think at this stage. I think we definitely need rain. That's the big factor. But we need late rain the year before, and then you need follow-up rain. We're into April now, so you know, it's too late for this year, I do think. And it's not just the prawns, it's the mud crabs, it's the barramundi. The rain affects the whole coastal fishery, and you know, we definitely need rain all the time. So we haven't had a good wet season for quite a while, so last year was a very poor prawn season for this area as well. It was probably the worst I've seen in 40 years. That's the king prawns and banana prawns. So, and we've got very few trawlers working these days. There's only a handful of boats left to operate, so things are getting a bit tight on the seafood production side.
You're in that same boat, I guess, as a farmer on land. It's crossing your fingers and hoping for the right weather.
Yep, we're at the mercy of the weather, and if we don't get it, we don't get the produce.
How do you feel about the future of the industry? Is it at a tipping point?
It is, and a lot of people are exiting the industry. A lot of people are getting out. They're just selling if they can and going. They've had enough. They see no future in the industry.
So what will that mean, do you think, in the future for the availability of Queensland seafood?
It'll be probably out of the reach of the normal person if people do stay in the industry. There may be just a few big operators operating. Otherwise, you'll be subject to imported product.
Regardless of how many prawns come in, the cost of fuel and the normal Easter bump all but guarantees the seafood spread will hit the pocket a little harder this year. As for the giant black prawn hauled in on the Fraser Coast, fisherman John Helmuth says its future is still unknown.
Oh, he's just chilling in the freezer.
Very lucky fisherman John Helmuth, ending that report from Kelly Buchanan. Global mining giant BHP has inked a deal to bankroll a major wind farm in Western Australia's Great Southern region. The deal between the miner and startup company Mooney's Hill, which is backed by Italian green energy heavyweight Enel, will pave the way for a $200 million wind farm near Kojonup, 3 hours southeast of Perth. It'll involve the construction of 18 turbines up to 200 metres high, with work expected to start in July and be finished by the end of 2023. Power from the project will be used to offset emissions from BHP's Nickel West division. Matthew Bowen specialises in energy at the Perth-based law firm Jackson McDonald, and he says the deal is a sign of the times.
Look, I think the announcement is good news. This is the future, and it's happening right now.
The fact that it's BHP sort of obviously gives it a bit more weight, or at least is likelier to grab the attention. But is BHP alone in doing these sorts of things?
What's happening is, across Australia, across the whole economy, corporations are moving to decarbonise. And what's driving that is, well, just today we got the latest United Nations climate report, and that shows that we need this decade to do wide-scale decarbonisation. And this is a massive task. The good news is there is still just time to avoid the worst outcomes. We've had the federal government's failure to act for the last decade, but the good news there is that businesses like BHP, like many others, are responding anyway. For some, for many, it's because they accept the science. But in fact, even that's becoming irrelevant because outside forces are driving large corporations to decarbonise.
You know, would it be fair to say that this latest wave of renewable energy projects across the country is being driven more by business than by any guidance by the federal government?
Dan, I think that's exactly correct. I think companies are being driven to decarbonise by a whole range of factors. Financial markets are calling for it. So their insurers, their banks, their financiers, their shareholders are increasingly calling for it. Importantly, critically in Western Australia, the customers are demanding this. So most of our major iron ore customers are demanding decarbonisation. And many of the markets that we export to are talking of imposing carbon tariffs. And finally, the community is calling for it. And in a decade, a polluting business will begin to lose its social license to operate.
Companies like BHP are obviously very significant polluters in their own right. Try as they might to minimise their emissions, inherent in a lot of what they do is the generation of pollution. So, I mean, how does BHP decarbonise?
For companies like BHP and many others, there are two main paths to decarbonisation. The first is, where they already use electricity in their business, they need to source that electricity from a renewable resource rather than from fossil fuel power generation. And that's what's happening here with BHP and Mooney's Hill. The other way is, where they currently use diesel in their business, they need to replace those diesel motors with electric ones, and then run those electric engines also on renewable energy. So deals like the one BHP is doing here to source its electricity from renewable sources are becoming more common. These deals are still completely achievable, and we are seeing more and more of them.
So if BHP is doing this and it's not alone, what's the scale of the task ahead of these companies? How much, and you know, how far have they come along?
We're probably still in the early days of major operations decarbonising. And the scale of the task is huge. In Western Australia alone, over the next decades, we are going to see billions of dollars invested in decarbonisation, in renewable energy. And that is going to go in building very large wind and solar farms, building the networks and the batteries to support it, and in converting all of those diesel motors to electric motors.
The electricity grid, when you're connected to it, the electricity in it is totally interchangeable with any other electricity coming into it. It's just like a giant pool. And so BHP won't be necessarily taking the power from this wind farm directly. It will be getting its power from the grid, and much of the power in that grid will still be generated by coal and gas-fired plants. Is there a degree of greenwashing in a deal or an announcement like this?
This is not greenwashing. Done properly, renewable contracts like this are making a genuine change of substituting polluting energy and replacing it by green energy. And the way to think about it is this. Our electricity grid is like a large reservoir, and we all draw power from that reservoir. And you're right, there's a mix of polluted and clean energy in that reservoir. The reservoir is fed by many streams. So if you want to start cleaning up the reservoir, what you could do is say, look, for the energy that I draw from the reservoir, I'm going to contract with someone to make sure that they are putting in clean energy to match what I take out. Now, it's true that the electrons that actually arrive at your property will be a mixture of dirty and clean electrons. But the fact of the matter is that by making sure that the energy that you have bought into the pool is clean, you've made that pool a little bit cleaner for everyone. And over time, as more and more consumers get their suppliers to replace dirty streams with clean ones, the reservoir will become clean.
Jackson McDonald, partner and energy specialist Matthew Bowen, speaking to energy reporter Daniel Mercer. In a push to boost farm productivity, more and more data is being collected off farms and fed into different bits of software. Harvesters record crop yields in real time. Sensors can identify the exact location of individual weeds and fire off a targeted burst of herbicide, while remote sensors on water tanks can alert farmers to leaks or potentially thirsty livestock. But some farmers feel they're losing a grip on the data that they believe is theirs and definitely not for sale to a third party, while others want access to that data so they can build more powerful and accurate technology. That's why I was interested this week in a new partnership between the Food Agility Cooperative Research Centre, Bosch and the University of Technology Sydney that's aiming to help farmers protect their data while allowing other parties to access it safely. Richard Norton is the CEO of the Food Agility CRC.
Like all of us, everything we do in any transaction, be it online or business, is generating data. So when you go to farming enterprises, all the equipment purchases that are now multi-million dollar pieces of machinery, to livestock transactions, to interacting with databases around traceability of livestock, the farm is generating a lot of data through its general day-to-day practices.
There's a saying in social media that if the product is free, it means you are the product. But in agriculture, much of the software I'm aware of is subscription-based. So does that change the dynamic between the user, the farmer, and the supplier or the vendor of that technology?
That's true. And what we're trying to achieve here is taking those subscription-based data collection mechanisms and in telling farmers exactly how that data is going to be used for a wider industry benefit around productivity or research through technologies like clean room environments where people can work on the data, but farmers know what the data is being used for and it's entrusted in an encrypted environment so that, like any of us, farmers don't find that their data is being used for any number of things outside of what they potentially wanted it used for.
And so this partnership between the University of Technology in Sydney and Bosch and Food Agility CRC, it has three main focus areas. I know you just mentioned one of them with the data clearinghouses, but can you expand a bit on what those three areas are?
And the three areas really are about getting down into the detail. So you hear a lot of language about farmers should share data, they should feel comfortable about sharing data. But what we're doing is into the detail. About to tell farmers why they should trust sharing their data and what frameworks are in place around the technology and the legal framework so that they feel comfortable sharing their data. So the three aims of this project with Bosch and UTS are establishing that framework for inception that protects the data, and then the data modelling. So a high quality machine learning model from sensitive data that's aggregated across some of those subscription providers that you spoke about and farmers, but in a manner that is preserving the privacy of that data. As I spoke about, exchanging data in clean rooms. And a clean room fundamentally means that the data owners can maintain the ownership when uploading into the digital marketplace and retain full control and transparency over how their data is being used.
Some farmers spoke to Landline earlier this year and they said that they felt they were being individually farmed for their data. What are your thoughts on the line between, yeah, the right of the farmers to own their data and the need, especially maybe in the startup space, for companies to have enough data to make their algorithms and code actually work smoothly and accurately?
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're trying to achieve through this project is again, going into that detail and telling a farmer how this actually works. So those subscription-based models that are actively collecting data because there's a partnership between the farmer and that farm management tool. Now, if the farmer and the subscription-based supplier wants that data to go and be used for research or other commercial activities, we're providing the framework so that data is held in a private environment where it's not going to be hacked. And secondly, with the legal framework for that to be achieved so that all parties know their obligations and there's no data breaches. That's what we're attempting to do with this project, is actually give farmers the knowledge of what their data is being used for so that they know the value of that data as well. And I think that's what farmers are looking for. So they're naturally, people are skeptical about sharing data. There is publicly available data that'll be mined through ABS to give out insurance policies or any other number of things to farmers. But this is about taking specific farm data that farmers may share with service providers and then building on that.
So once the framework is produced through this partnership, are you looking to then go to government to enshrine it in law or get some process around how farmers might bring a software company to the table to use the framework?
Firstly, if we get the environment right through encrypted databases or trusted execution environments for farmers and food services industry, and then overlay it with the legal contract, if one would like to think that industry and everyone participating within that model, that model will work. It's when that model fails that you would go to government to intervene and start writing legislation. So at this point in time, we're just getting or trying to get the whole of industry to share data, because I think there's things that I don't know that some 25-year-old, the 35-year-old in university today will help us deliver better productivity gains when they have the data to work on. And what we're providing is that clean room environment so that people know what their data is being used for.
So if I'm a farmer and my harvester is collecting a lot of valuable information about yields in real time, the percentage of weed seeds in the crop, I will then have an option to share that data if I want and know that the chance of it being breached or shared with someone that I didn't want it to be shared with will be quite low.
That's right. And we're using the same type of technology that when you buy online, or as any number of us do buy online, and we enter our credit card details. We have the innate trust in entering our credit card details that it's not going to be breached and that we're not going to be ripped off. That doesn't work, but 99% of the time it does. And that's what we're setting up here, the same sort of technology around the data coming off farm.
And just like the credit card, in the farm sense, things like yields, crop yields, livestock metrics, that's really valuable information in the wrong hands, right?
Exactly. I don't think anyone wants any of their data breached, even in horticulture and viticulture, around predicted yields, around quality of the product, or around any of the applications that are used to grow that crop. That's all very sensitive data that could lead to productivity up gains. If you're a large corporate that's got multiple farming enterprises across Australia, you want to share that data to increase your productivity and ultimately product profitability, but want to do it in an environment that you know that data is not going to end up somewhere in the domain of data that other people can see. So particularly, one of the areas that we're working with, ASX listed companies have obligations around ensuring that their data doesn't get breached. And this project is about providing the ability to share data so it's not breached, but multiple parties can use that data to build, as you said, AI and robotics in farming and sensors and predictions, etc.
The partnership has just been announced this week. Do you have any idea of the timeline of the project and when we might see this framework out in the world and working?
So the legal framework, which we've set up around a data sharing agreement with oversight from National Farmers Federation that incorporates their data code. The first draft's been released and is on the Food Agility website for anyone wants to have a look at that. That was built in conjunction with a tier one legal firm, and it is the first draft. It's a way of providing people the legal framework of which data can be shared across the value chain in agriculture. The next step is this project with Bosch and UTS around the technology framework and establishing that this framework is already in place across other sectors and bringing it into place. So we'd hope to have some real outcomes within 12 months with the technology side of this project.
CEO of the Food Agility CRC, Richard Norton. My name's Clint Jasper. My thanks to Serena Locke, Kath McAllen and Matthew Sigley for helping put the show together this week. There's a picture of the big prawn on the Country Brekkie website, so go check that out. But now it's time to pass the mic to my wonderful Saturday morning colleagues to find out what's up next here on RN.